I suppose I could do this informally and just sit through the whole talk, but anyway, so this is like cod liver oil that your mother gave you when you were a kid. This is good for you even though you won't like it. You theorists need to be more skeptical when someone puts some data in front of you from your favorite journal of non-reproducible results. Since Gene Wells is retired, I can't name the specific journal anymore with impunity because the new guy might not like it. But anyway.
Can I just remind you of you recorded it?
Yeah, and my lawyer has consulted on what I can say. Anyway. This is a very informal talk. If you don't interrupt me, I'll feel badly. So please interrupt all the time. Here's Will anyway, is between bites of pasta salad. Yes. That's for posterity to know what here's the salad. Oh, okay. So this is a very lengthy outline, and I'm not going to make you read it now. I'll make you read it during the talk. So the first issue we're going to talk about is not really a materials problem. It's an experimental problem. We need low temperature data, and various reasons for this, a few of which are because if you don't have some temperature dependence over a decade of temperature, it doesn't mean much. So if you have log T between 4 Kelvin and 10 Kelvin, who cares? You shouldn't. Okay. Theories typically want the limiting low temperature response, where they can do simplifications in their expansions and in their approach to calculating things. So you really like low temperature. So please don't go off and write some theory explaining data that only go down to 1.4 Kelvin. Only write a preliminary theory if the data go down to 0.3 Kelvin. Is Catherine here? Oh, darn. and you really want 50 millikelvin. You really want low temperature data. So, as I said,
what dictates this particular choice of numbers?
Okay. These are experimentalist signposts. For instance, I'm going to show you data today, which you have seen at this workshop a few weeks ago, that went down initially to 4 Kelvin. And that's liquid helium 4 not pumped. Okay? 1.4 is liquid helium 4 pumped. And I'm just saying if someone isn't willing to pump their helium 4, they're not working very hard, then you should be skeptical about their data. And if you want to talk about the zero temperature response, I'll show you many examples today where data down to 0.3, in fact, miss the lowest temperature response. And if you go and try to base your understanding on how a system is behaving under the impact of some external parameter, and you're not measuring it below 0.3 Kelvin, whereas you may, in fact, not be looking at what you thought you were looking at.
So, Greg, surely this depends on the type of system you're thinking about.
Yes.
So, high temperature superconductor maybe, or just elevators versus 0.03 doesn't matter.
I'm sorry, did I turn wrong on my bus this morning? I thought this was a quantum phase transition.
Quantum phase transitions can apply equally well to cool plate systems and heavy electrical systems.
Let's talk about some specific examples rather than being so theoretical in our approach. It's like cod liver oil. You like it. So here are famous examples of data that didn't go low enough where important questions about simple questions were not answered. So for example, uranium, copper, 4, palladium, which is close, depending on whether it's an yield or not, to a TNAL being suppressed to zero by the doping quantum critical point, and you see these data, which didn't go down to 50 millikelvin, leave you hanging as to which temperature dependence and which physics are involved. Now, when you take these data, and I'll show these a little later, down lower in temperature, in fact, they follow log T down to 50, 60, 80 millikelvin. Okay, so that's a decided question. This also looks decided. Let me point this out.
Wait, question me. You choose two particular dependencies, one power law and one log.
That's right.
I assume that you choose something in between.
You could.
That even if you go to lower temperature, still will not be able to distinguish.
Well, here, you don't find the two that are put on this graph. You find, get a third. I believe this is, there is a theoretical work on another system similar to this. This is actually, I think, a hot topic among certain theorists these days. What happens if the data actually diverge faster than either of those temperature dependencies? And there are many systems where this is observed.
I'm sorry. Can you just say one particular lambda?
Yeah, what is lambda?
This is trying to fit it over an extended temperature range with one lambda. If you allow lambda to be a function of temperature, yes.
You take particular lambda. If you take lambda smaller, making power law looking more like log, you probably will not be able to distinguish between power law and log down to much lower temperature.
Okay.
So the question is where to stop.
What we're doing is we're starting here and we're fitting some log and we're fitting some power law and then we're extrapolating and see how the dice lie.
What's the lambda?
What is the lambda for those fits?
Could you ask which one first, the specific one?
All three.
Okay, well, let's start at the top. Uranium, copper, for palladium, since that happens to be in here first. It's around 0.7, could be 0.71, could be 0.68, depends on the folk.
Okay, and the middle one?
The lower two look flatter. I mean, there's a smaller difference between lambda, between T to the power and the log. So I assume lambda gets closer to 1 in these two fits. Is that
okay? Right. Okay. I'm going to answer your question. I actually don't read this table every night before I go to bed, so I'll have to. Here it is. If you take the lowest temperature data for the middle system, lambda is about 0.8.
Yeah, okay.
Closer to 1. Right. And the bottommost one, that's back at the front of the table, that's our founding member of the non-Fermi liquid, 0.76.
Okay.
Good. Okay. So all I'm trying to point out here is if you measured down to 1.4, you really wouldn't have had an idea. And if you measured to 0.3 for this system, you wouldn't have had the idea that there's interesting physics down there. There's something happening where the behavior, at least at higher temperature, does not imply with any specificity what's happening at lower temperature. Now, this could be, to follow along with some comment or other, this could be some crossover behavior, where in one temperature range, the behavior is something, and at lower temperature, it's something else. For example, and I know I have always made a mistake. I've always been chastised that I listed this name here as well. But on the paper where I got this from originally, he was there. He's actually the one that supplied us with the PIT program so that we could do this in our lab. And I understand he's a famous guy, but anyway. So this is actually encouraging to experimentalists. If you give us a crossover prediction, so one temperature range, in this example it's log, and in this temperature range it's constant minus square root of T, this is actually encouraging. This gives us some flexibility. This gives us something to go look for. And it seems somehow more realistic, because thinking that we're always in the low temperature limit, even at 50 millikelvin, is naive. We're certainly not in the low temperature limit. I really doubt any of the systems measured really truly have C over T diverging at nanokelvin. It's going to saturate. There's no way you're right where you need to be. There's going to be some Fermi liquid behavior down there somewhere. And you might learn something if you went and looked. Now, unfortunately, having said that, The experiment that you most want to do at low temperature, the simplest one, the one where you put least heat into the machine and therefore not affect its lowest temperature so much, would be resistivity. And what you do when you take a resistivity bar to the microkelvin guys at University of Florida is they say, those 2 mil platinum wires, those are too small. We're going to get competes of resistance at the contacts, even though they're spot welded, even though they're really a pretty good metallic joint. That's not going to work. Here, take these wires back to your lab and put those up, and then they give you 10 mil silver wires. Now the problem with the catching, I understand this is an experimental problem, not a material problem, but then silver is a material, so look at it that way. When you try to spot weld something that huge, it carries heat back up the wire so well that you can never, ever, ever spot weld a 10 mil silver wire on a sample small enough where the cross section is going to give you some voltage at low temperature and going to give you a resistance value.
Because giving us an analysis of correction, we can't reach zero temperature. Well, I mean, what does the...
Taking data down in the 5 microkelvin regime is really seriously difficult for looking at these sorts of materials. And one of the problems is, I hope some people can see this here.
There's a light switch.
Well, it's not the question of that, it's just the question that the screen is blocking some people's view from the right. Will not eventually will kill you. Because the temperature dependence, whatever it is so small compared to the constant that you need really, really, really precise data. For instance, just to harken back to Andy McKenzie's talk, which was nicely broad, he's talking about only measuring down in one set of experiments to 0.2 because his data is noisier below there. He can't give you accurate numbers. And the reason is because you're measuring the difference between 1.001 and 1.000, and that's hard to do.
Greg, can I ask a question? I guess there are two different things mixed up in your two transparencies. This crossover behavior is a behavior when the system has some internal energy scale. I presume it's J in antiferromagnetic case. And you change behavior roughly on the scale of J. This is a change of physics. But at the same time, when you do your measurements and you want to go to lower and lower temperature, as you said, the system eventually will become Fermi liquid. So you are losing interest in behavior,
right,
which is quantum critical behavior. And this is different from what you have here.
Yes.
And then the question is this. Obviously, if you want to go to the lowest temperatures, you will be in a Fermi liquid condition. You will not be able to be exactly at the critical point.
But you might.
Are you saying that in the intermediate temperature regime, where we are about to see quantum critical behavior, you cannot distinguish between the logarithm and power?
Not over a wide enough temperature range with current experimental techniques. Let me go back to the viewer. This was just meant to be a plea. If you guys find crossover behavior, don't throw the baby out with the dishwater. Don't just give us the lowest temperature behavior.
Right.
Give us the next
crossover from.
Give us the next step up.
Actually, I would say even in that theory plot, you shouldn't put log T on the line.
It's not over a decade. Someone's listening. Thank you.
That was his point, I thought. That the curves were actually the crossover that's associated with constant minus square root T. Is that
right?
And but if you take any curve, and
if you only measure down to some level, you would have gotten log T between 4 and 10 Kelvin and published it. And
but I believe that the theorists in that particular case would use this kind of plot as a reason for why their theory explains logs in the data. Anyway, go on.
Then there is a reason for why some people may not find it convincing, because they would tell you that any monotonous curve can be fit by any other monotonous curve.
Well, we go into danger of discussion.
Yeah. Monotonous is just boring.
Yes.
If we focus on this set of data.
Yes.
Obviously, at low temperature, you should see deviation both from a power law, from log, And this is what you see in the data.
Right.
The issue is, do we have enough weeks of temperature?
No. You can't go down to this little deviation range and fit any convincing, although it's been done in another system by a theorist who's not here, so I shouldn't attack her in her absentia.
But Greg, I'm sorry, I mean, as a theorist, if in that power law fit, lambda gets closer to 1,
right.
I would argue that you shouldn't see much difference between log and the power
I agree,
law.
Exactly.
Right? So the question is whether one can distinguish it from t to power 1, 2, minus 1, minus 2, not t to the power 0.1.
Exactly, that's precisely the point. That somehow there should be some belief in theory. Namely, that if you have log, of course, if you want to feed it by power t to the power 0.1, you will be able to feed it. So obviously there will be a function that will be close to log t over some temperature.
Yes.
And you cannot distinguish log by some closed function.
Well, you can in this system when you take data down to 50 milligrams because it follows along here instead of up there. But what you're saying is, let me just fit it in the lowest temperature range, and then I can still have power law looking just as good as log.
No, I'm saying that you definitely should be able, if you want to feed it by quantum critical formulas in the first place, should be able to see some intermediate temperature range, not extremely low, up to some temperature, which is a high end, and then try either log or some other power, which is really far from log.
Okay, you can't fit something to these data as we've discussed, is that when I answered Ilya's question, the numbers, lambda is 0.8,
which just means that power is 0.2.
I'm sorry, I was telling you lambda.
Yeah, well, minus 1 plus lambda.
I'm sorry, I was telling you lambda, I wasn't telling you minus 1 plus
right.
lambda.
Right. Exactly, so power is 0.2.
Okay,
power is
0.8, right.
Power is 0.2, that's what I'm saying.
All right, well, maybe I'm confused, but we're not arguing that we should go to 0.3 and fit these data to some power law or law of dependence. Okay. So these are just random examples. Pointing out that when you get down to lower temperatures in this system where we're suppressing anti-ferromagnetism with doping regime here, that at the lowest temperature we often get deviations. Not just the deviation we saw in the previous few graphs for the yttrium, uranium, palladium 3, the prototypical non-thermoliquid system, Seaman et al., Indianapolis, 1991, but you can see maybe this is some small transition, maybe this is the anti-ferromagnetism spread out. There are gremlins at low temperature. There are second phases, there are effects of disorder that aren't intrinsic, they're extrinsic.
But is the nature of the order of phase established in this particular system?
Yes, it's anti-ferromagnetism.
Oh, so there's the last neutron that has been now?
Probably not. I think that's more looking at the susceptibility and looking at the field dependence. So you're asking, is it canonical anti-ferromagnetism or is it a spin density wave?
I mean, this seems like the discussion is what we can extract from data. And there's usually a tendency of looking at the power laws and saying that this is quantum critical or not. But we really should reverse the procedure and first establish a phase diagram and then.
Okay, well, there has been, this is actually phrased with malice aforethought. This is some ordering, this is some magnetic ordering temperature as yet imperfectly defined, and the magnetic ordering temperature is going to zero. So it's your point that we should be looking at the specific nature of the magnetic order before we try to look at
helps.
Okay.
Great. Another question, and let me know if I'm rushing sort of ahead and you'll return to it. All examples that you showed us here are examples of non-stoichiometric compounds. But you talk about low temperature behavior. So the question is, are the problems with determining low temperature power laws and logs more pronounced in non-stoichiometric compounds or than stoichiometric, or is, are these two completely different issues?
Okay. The problem with distinguishing the temperature dependence is the same whether it's stoichiometric or not. The problem with spurious effects, which is actually my central point for today, thank you for predicting this, this is a paid advertisement from Ilya there in the background, is actually much worse in these DOTE systems than in stoichiometric systems. Stoichiometric systems, by their nature, are cleaner and have fewer spurious effects. I didn't say zero. Okay, so that was just to show you that even though specific heat is my favorite measurement technique, that I am willing to discuss others that the data, I'm just showing you that there's something happening down here in the resistivity. Not only don't we know the nature of the magnetic order, but we don't understand the resistivity to save our lives. This is a huge number. Had this deviation, it's some effects. We don't know. So I think to forecast Qingyao's complaint, this was a bad system to waste our energies characterizing, because it would take a whole lot of effort to better characterize it, and we might never be able to. So this sort of experimental, quick and dirty look is quite common. Let's go look at the system. This system was looked at because it had been looked at by Andraka previously, and he published some data analyzed in a different way that seemed to show us that maybe there was something there from a log T behavior. So it was a quick student package project where we just went and looked, could we answer the question? This was not meant to be a thesis where 3 years' effort was going to answer a major question. This was a quick look. Some more cod liver oil. The next time an experimentalist tells you, we have single crystals, please look at this person with skepticism and disbelief. Single crystals often don't mean anything in terms of quality. Residual resistivity is important. Resistivity ratio, resistance at 300 divided by resistance at extrapolated to T equals zero. Both of those measures mean something as to the quality of the material. The fact that it's a single crystal can actually be deleterious. That's harmful for the blogger. Anyway, for example, if you look carefully at the previous one of these that I wrote, at the graphs for superconducting uranium beryllium 13, you will find that the single crystal TC is 15 to 20% lower than the polycrystalline TC, 0.75 versus 0.9 Kelvin, and the TC width is 2 or 3 times larger in the single crystal than it is in the polycrystal. That was not explicitly mentioned in the article due to political considerations at the place at work. The reason is, when you grow single crystals, not all of us have Onuki's mirror furnace where the substance never touches anything. Mostly, crystals are grown touching a material. There's a famous example at Argonne where they grew zirconium zinc 2 single crystals in an alumina crucible, and they had 4% aluminum in the sample because it just leached it out of the crucible material. When you made uranium beryllium 13 crystals in an aluminum flux, it turns out something up to 0.5% of aluminum goes into the lattice and depresses TC. So it's a single crystal. From the X-ray point of view, it's better ordered, but that doesn't mean it's better, cleaner, more intrinsic, more characteristic of the material. Mosaic spread. Suppose I have a single crystal and my X-rays penetrate in 2,000 layers, which is sort of realistic. And I look at the alignment of these layers. And suppose all the layers are not parallel. So suppose some of them are tilted with respect to one another. Then when I look where my C-axis is pointing on this crystal, instead of being perpendicular to my supposedly flat platelet, it can have a spread of directions known as the mosaic spread. It can be several degrees in good crystals. So you need to be careful.
But can I ask a theorist question? So
please.
If somebody shows data from single crystal, how do I know it's a good data? What's the sort of the dangerous signals for?
Well, again, I would look at the residual resistivity grown up. I just take Andy McKenzie's example, where he talked about his early generation strontium ruthenates, where he had residual resistivities of 2.8 microns, and got a certain set of physics out of his characterization, which he presented here. You guys have seen this if you were here for his talk. And then later he did better crystals with lower residual resistivities instead of 2.8 down below 1 microcentimeter, and he found different physics. He found a different temperature dependence in a low temperature resistivity. We're not talking about nitpicking differences, we're talking about a central point of the characterization of the quantum theoretical point.
So you're saying that there's an inelastic contribution, the change as a function of temperature versus the residual value of resistivity would be a good...
Extremely important.
But amplifying up Jimmy's question, will it be sufficient to say that if you have temperature dependence that well exceeds residual resistivity, then it should be taken as almost single crystal data?
Repeat the question.
If resistivity varies with temperature such that it becomes much larger than residual resistivity.
No, it's not a measurement problem, it's a physics problem. The temperature dependence of the resistivity changes. It's not this problem over here, it's the physics changes.
Well, but, correct. Again, if I, as a theorist, I look at somebody that shows me the data on a sort of 2 microcentimeter crystal, my first reaction is to say, well, this is probably good. You're telling it's not good enough, and it's true in the particular example, what used to be a very high power law became a minimum, right?
Right.
That's what you're referring to.
Yes. I'm not saying that 2 is good, I'm not saying 1 is good, I'm saying you should examine it and not just say, oh, it's a single crystal. Everything's perfect in there.
Can we turn this around? I mean, how do I, there are different kinds of single crystals, but let me ask this question. How do I tell from a polycrystalline alloy whether it's good or not?
From the
width. How do I have the same level of rigor on that data as I do on a single crystal?
Well,
I would propose that it's impossible to do. But measured by the same standards you're trying to impose on single crystal work,
I'm not trying.
You have to give up on the polycrystalline just doesn't reach the same levels of rigor.
I'm not trying to call polycrystal data into question. I'm trying to create a certain healthy skepticism on your part towards experimentalist data. And if you'll just be patient. Thank you. So I gave you one example where you could look at the resistivity ratio or the residual resistivity in the polycrystalline material. If it's a superconductor, you can look at the transition width. If it's some material or other, pick a random one, you can look at the extra line width as a function of how it's treated. There are many ways to characterize polycrystalline material that will show for specific systems that single crystals are far, far better. And there are certain, you know, cerium, iridium, indium 5, as published by the Los Alamos group, had a resistive transition to TC at 1.2 Kelvin and a bulk transition at 0.4 Kelvin. And I'm not sure that the correct explanation is the one I'm about to say, but I believe that was a surface issue on the single crystal by etching it out of the indium flux. I'm just asking you to be as cautious with a single crystal as you would be with a polycrystal. Single crystals are often better. I don't care. 90% often. I don't care. I'm just asking you to be rigorously inquiring. Okay. So, one of the problems with single crystals is they're often small. These are uranium platinum 3 out of bismuth flux. These are Zach's original crystals that we discovered superconductivity on. And historical slide. Sometimes, I'm not against single crystals. I love single crystals. Why do you always put words in my mouth? Here's an instance where you had to have a single crystal. Looking at field-induced non-Fermi liquid behavior in cerium, copper, 6-doped with silver, when I was in Augsburg, this is Carsten Heuser's thesis project. We did initially polycrystalline work, put on a field, only went down to 0.3 Kelvin, saw what we thought was convincing behavior, later made single crystals, later discovered that it's really only non-Fermi liquid field-induced in the C direction, the easy axis, and that if you put on enough field in the A or B direction, when you get to TNAL going to zero, you suppress all the fluctuations and it's Fermi liquid-like. So in this system, you had to have a single crystal to characterize the intrinsic behavior. I believe it's true that Perry and Gregera and McKenzie and all those people find the most interesting behavior in a particular direction in their single crystals. So there's another example where polycrystalline just wouldn't do. I'm not attacking single crystals. I'm putting on an addendum to your understanding.
Could you remind us, in cerium corporate gold, the resistivity is anisotropic but not vastly anisotropic.
Factor 2 or 3, that's correct. And we're just seeing here that the magnetic properties in terms of the depression of TNAL, a well-characterized magnetic system by neutron scattering and other measurements, is also crystalline direction dependent. Okay. Next item on the outline, item 3, not making you read the outline all the time. Systems with metamagnetic transitions. This is a very old U-graph. This is just some examples, just pointing out that there are wildly different metamagnetic fields in strontium 3, ruthenium 2, oxygen 7, just to, again, to harken back to things you've heard. There are two metamagnetic transitions, one number for the AD plane and one number for the C direction. And they're different by a factor of 2, 2.5. They're wildly different. You all know that more or less the definition of what is a metamagnetic transition is it's something where there's some nonlinear increase in the magnetization as a function of field. And then right-hand column was talking about the delta M that was involved in this nonlinear increase. And you see uranium platinum 3 where we found the field-induced non-Fermi liquid behavior at the metamagnetic transition, which was somewhat strenuous to do since that's at 20.5 tesla. This is a rather broad transition. You've seen a lot of work by Marcelo Jaime, Neil Harrison, and also by our group on looking at the behavior at these various metamagnetic transitions, of which there are 3, in uranium, ruthenium 2, silicon 2. There's been, of course, a lot of interest in this system. We did some work in the cerium, iridium, indium 5, which I want to come back to, but you see this is a very broad, washed out, in single crystal transition, first discovered by a Japanese group.
Can I turn the tables on you? The lowest temperature here is 1.3 Kelvin.
Right. As you go lower in temperature, these will sharpen up a little bit. If you look, for instance, again, harkening back to things you've seen, so I don't have to show everyone else's U-graphs again, when McKenzie was here on the website, there is a plot of his metamagnetic transition as a function of field, and it sharpens up. But usually, if the characteristic field is of order 5, 10 tesla, the characteristic temperature where it sharpens up pretty much all the sharper it's going to get is usually a fifth or a tenth of that. So If you've got a 10 Tesla metamagnetic transition by 2 Kelvin, it's about as sharp as it's going to get.
So for example, for UPT3, this is intrinsically broad transmission?
Yep. Okay. In single crystals, with a particular mosaic spread. Yes.
Can we ask that in, well, maybe all of these, or some of these, can you analyze the sharpening of this transition at zero temperature and extrapolate to zero temperature to ask whether zero temperature transition typically is first order, as one naively would expect, or second order?
I think the answer is, and it's too bad Andy McKenzie is not here, in his original work, where they had the 2.8 microohm centimeter stuff, it did not extrapolate to first order, and looking at those data wasn't going to help you.
I'm not interested in looking at it because we have enough discussions about it. Any of these ones that you just listed in a previous slide?
Well, uranium platinum 3, the answer is no. Cerium, iridium, indium 5, the answer is no. I haven't worked in cerium, iridium, 2 for a while. Is that believed to be first order at 8 Tesla?
I just don't know. I mean, so uranium platinum 3, that's first order of transition?
No.
It's not even a transition. I wouldn't call it a transition. It's just
it's a broad,
a gentle crossover between two.
Right.
But which ones have transition?
Which ones have first order?
First order or?
Well, now let's be a little cautious. If we go and look at the Dehaustin-Alfin in uranium platinum 3 through the metamagnetic transition, what could we see? That's been looked at.
Oh, the Fermi surface, you're saying,
well, yeah.
Reconstructs or not.
That's what I'm trying to remember. Mm-hmm. I wasn't prepared for your question. I apologize.
And I think it's important because all these discussions about resonates being the end point of a first order line, that seems like an accident. That should happen too frequently, right?
Sorry.
So if you have enough of examples of what look like a second order phase transition under the field, that would suggest to me that it's something more generic that's operating as opposed to be some fine tuning.
Okay. My prejudice would be that these transitions are not first order.
And you think that there is a transition?
These transitions means what? I mean, if I look at one of these curves, the uranium routine to silicon, that has a fair chance of being a first order transition. Whereas the UPT3 looks rather, I'm above my critical endpoint. I'm just doing
We've tried at high field beta taking really very careful measurements to show that the specific heat transition at this field is first order, and we failed with the best crystals anyone's got. And I tried to present it as first order at a meeting where Norman Phillips was in the audience, and he clogged me. So I believe it's, I mean.
This seems like an interesting issue.
It is. And I want to come back to it after I've had a chance to go back and look at the literature and the Dehaustin-Alfin across this field range, rather than calling it transition.
Because last week we heard some field-driven transitions in some insulating magnets. Which looks like really in the week before last week.
Right. But,
and it seems like legitimate to ask.
Those are different beasts.
I understand that.
Right.
They have all run by all the time.
Let's leave that for a discussion point this week. That would be a marvelous discussion point. I'll go try to learn some more about the Dehaustin-Alfin across here. I will go remind myself what our competitors in the uranium ruthenium 2 silicon 2 case say. I believe Marcelo Jaime thinks there's a first order phase transition somewhere in this phase diagram.
But there are enough intermetallic compounds which have genuine first order metamagnetic transitions. I mean, they just do exist.
Right, and they don't have non-family liquid behavior at those conditions.
I see, in any, you can just go.
Right. So I'm trying to select a subset here that have interesting low temperature behavior. I'm not saying that all systems that have nonlinear rises in their inverse of H curves. Right. This was a subset. So we've already talked about this point, importance of Ronod. In the early material, which is interesting to point out, since we're just looking at the previous curves, Perry et al. Found one metamagnetic transition. A year later, Omichi, in better material, found two metamagnetic transitions. And a year after that, then Perry and Gregera and those people confirmed that. So the quality of the crystals there was very important. See?
Close in field, or they were hidden, but they're close enough in field and they were hidden in the crystal, or they're completely different and one has a smaller stack, and that's why you didn't see it in the earlier sample.
In the low field metamagnetic transition at 5 tesla, I could be off by a half a tesla here, they're like half a tesla, 0.7 tesla separated. In the big magnetic field direction, which is like 15 tesla, and they're more separated, also as a percentage. I think they missed them early because it was a fairly broad transition. Ronot was not low enough to give you a sharp transition. But if you look at Chi prime, or if you look at DMDH, it's quite obvious in the data. It's not something to miss.
I thought it's really called field, actually. If I remember correctly, the data that Andy actually showed were in the old samples with a large Ronot, were actually extremely broad.
Yes.
And only when they went to the low Ronot sample, yeah, they actually saw that there was really two steps. So but they were broad in age, basically.
Right, but if you took, I want to guess, although I haven't done it, if you took their old data and scanned it and looked at the first derivative, you might see something. I mean, the physics is there.
Well, I mean, you can turn it around. Basically, any short is new data and superimpose the old data. And of course, if you know that there are indeed two first order transitions,
right,
then you guess it from the old data. But the old data did not support that.
That's correct.
Right, can I show previous upgrades once again? You look at uranium or into silicon too.
Here.
Yeah. Are we talking about these two transitions? Or it looks like two transitions here.
There's three. There's this one, there's this one, and there's this one.
And are we talking about this thing?
No, we're talking about strontium 3, ruthenium 2,
is it similar to, or
if you go look at terms of a percentage, mm-hmm. And you plotted this on H over H metamagnetic,
mm-hmm.
except for the fact that the second transition in the ruthenate is the smaller one rather than the bigger one, it wouldn't look that dissimilar from this separation. I mean, I can show you.
Okay, there's no need to go with that.
Are we looking at these pictures because these systems have, at all of these transitions, non-family liquid behavior? Or at some of them, or at none of them? I mean, why are we looking at these specific plots at this point, actually?
This was meant to be an introduction to talking about the ruthenates, which I'm about to get to.
Okay.
This is meant to be field as a method for inducing non-family liquid behavior, and certainly...
We all have non-family liquid behavior somewhere.
Uranium-platinum 3 does, and I believe it's a correct statement that the others do not. So I'm just saying, if you want to go look for non-family liquid behavior, don't pick a metamagnetic transition in a correlated system. Certainly don't pick it in a insulating antiferromagnet, but don't necessarily pick it in a correlated electron system and expect to find it.
Well, I'm confused. If I have a first order transition, I wouldn't even be tempted to do so.
Excellent.
Now you're saying this has no first order transition.
That's correct.
If I do, therefore, DMDH, it is big, but not first order.
That's correct.
So something order fluctuates, and you're saying, don't bother.
You could go look and hope for non-family local behavior. I'm just saying it's not...
Well, nothing is guaranteed in this business.
Right, right. It's a good place to look.
Yeah.
Okay. So I just again want to talk about quality of crystals, and these are the excellent data from now 04, where this field axis has been disjointed. Zero is obviously somewhere over here, but this is where the residual resistivity would be on the axes. This is correct. And so you see in this material at the lower field, metamagnetic transition where it's not split in this sample, you see this broad transition, and then here it's sent to be first order, and it has these very sharp signs. I just showed this graph with no permission and point out the lowest temperature here, and you all know this because you went to this talk. At these temperatures in those older second generation crystals, the resistivity looked to have a green exponent or alpha was 3. The question that he raised in his talk was, could that be due to sample purity? And the answer is yes. So this is a statement that high purity single crystals can be extremely useful, and in fact, only and barely. Sometimes you can't do without them. Okay? So here's this sharp feature in the lower residual resistivity crystal, and here's this different temperature behavior than what they initially assigned as TQ in the green exponent in the previous graph.
So, I'm not really confused. And what's actually the experiment which says that the racemate has a phase transition, either second order in one direction or first order in the other direction? Because the only parameter doesn't distinguish between the two sides.
I believe, to go along with Dr. Schmelian's point, I believe if you look at DMDH, it's discontinuous was then very...
No, it depends. If the first order transition is never really big, it just jumps.
It jumps, yeah.
But what you showed is the MDH was big because it wasn't the first order transition.
I believe in this material, it seems relatively convincing that it's first order.
Well, I don't know what is that relatively convincing, but the answer is that M versus H contains all the information about whether there is a phase transition or there's not.
That's not what I'm claiming. They have lots of other measurements. Haven't they looked at the Hofstra alpha? I wasn't here for this talk. I believe there are several other pieces of evidence that taken together make a good argument for first.
So what's the operational definition?
Experiment,
you are seeing
thank you.
A genuine metamagnetic phase transition
Zero
temperature.
Oh, okay. See, metamagnetic is a bastard word.
Okay, let's not forget the word.
No, it's metamagnetic means a nonlinear rise in N versus H at some field.
Which every world.
Which lots of systems have. If you then want to apply some more rigorous definition to metamagnetic, it's an overused word.
No, what about second degree? D2M over the H square should have a sharp maximum at some field.
Yes.
Data function in ideal space.
But what's sharp?
Well, okay. But still. I mean, in conventional systems, we don't expect D2M over DH square to be peaked at some particular value.
Right.
The field.
These are a subset of systems, but there are many differing sets of physics under the umbrella of metamagnetic. I don't know if I'm answering your question. There was another comment. Am I answering your question? No.
I'm still relatively confused by the means.
Okay.
What's actually the problem? We have, it's just like liquid gas transition. It's a first order transition. And it's hard to measure, but it's very easy to define.
Many systems.
I understand that. But on the other hand, we saw five or six examples in one slide, right?
Yes.
Which had M versus H plot, which had this linear behavior. And I was told some of them showed genetic based recognition, others didn't.
Right. Well,
see, and see, exactly. I didn't ask the question.
Perfectly.
What's the operation?
Why? Definitely. Look at second derivative. Don't look at first derivative.
Okay.
Second derivative should be strongly peaked at some particular field. That is mathematical.
No, first order based transition, I never look at second order.
Look, we're not talking about the same word.
Transition.
I'm sorry. To you, metamagnetic means first order phase transition.
I don't have to. I just want to see whether there's a phase transition or not.
Okay. Answer is, most of the systems in highly correlated materials that show nonlinear N versus H, that's not a transition in your definition. Mm-hmm. The definition of metamagnetic, I can have the blogger read it back. It's a nonlinear rise in N versus H in some field. It's got nothing necessarily.
The crossover satisfies that work.
Yes.
So if one were, for example, to fix the field at the threshold and measure a specific heat.
As has been done.
Yes. So
in uranium 3, you get log T to the lowest temperature measurement.
And if you deviated from that,
it goes away very quickly in field.
But the point is that there is not a generally infinite temperature transition as you lower down the temperature at any point of the field, right?
That's
so
correct.
That makes it hard to identify the quantum transition as well.
Okay.
A major difficulty with the way this talk is going is the objective to just sow uncertainty, cynicism, and doubt about all experimental data, out of which a new understanding will later emerge tomorrow maybe. Or where are we going? Is of course you have to be skeptical about experimental results, all results. In all walks of theoretical and physics life, you have to be skeptical. It's healthy and important. You have to have reproducible results. You have to look at things with an eagle eye. Okay, we got the message. And now?
Moving on. I was being slowed down by questions.
I'm thinking that the whole idea of a quantum critical endpoint doesn't exist anymore. The whole idea of metamagnetism is on shaky grounds. Whereas actually, I think it's very well established. It's fine data. And I don't know why we're going on looking at this stuff as if it's very risque data. I think it's
okay.
Very, very
I would like to go on record as thinking that Mackenzie's data is beautiful and wonderful and insightful. Don't blog that otherwise. Thank you.
So what are we learning from this, and what should we be learning from it? Okay, skepticism is good. And now?
Would you like to hear about this topic, or should we go on?
It was a question about what the logistics. Okay, what are we supposed? Okay, so
I think we've had a healthy discussion. I think we've had a healthy discussion that there's more than one definition and more than one understanding of what the term metamagnetic transition means. Haven't you heard differing opinions from one side of your head and from the other side of your head? I thought that was a useful discussion.
We can continue with the discussion. I think the definition is very strict, but yes. Let's go to the second part of your talk.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I Pierce, if what I'm talking about seems boring or unhelpful to you, wave at me and I'll move on to the next subject. Somewhere in here there's something you like. So the next part of my planned talk was to point out to you that field-driven quantum critical points can have differing behavior than if you get there by doping or pressure. I'm not calling anyone's data into question. I'm not saying some data are bad, some data are good. I'm just pointing out that in these systems, just as an example for field-driven, and I also would like to point out that field only works in some cases to reach the quantum critical point. For instance, in the two other directions in the cerium, copper, 6, silver single crystals, field does not reach the quantum critical point there. So there are differences in the measured properties, and sometimes quite seriously so, depending on whether you got there with the red, with field, or whether you got there with the black, X-critical, or P-critical. For example, in cerium copper 6, doped with either silver or gold, if you get to the quantum critical point using field, you get this temperature dependent behavior. If you get there with sloping or pressure, you get this temperature dependence. So I don't know whether that's of interest to you. I'm just pointing out that differing routes to the quantum critical point give you differing behaviors as you get there.
But this goes back to the very first transparency that you showed. Can you really distinguish between, say, log and power close to zero?
You can certainly distinguish between log and constant minus square root of t. Because constant minus the square root of t bends over.
Great. I think I'm confused here.
And sounds diverging.
So there is one, so if I have my phase space with x, p, b, there is one critical point, a particular x critical, p critical, b critical, or not. What are we comparing?
I don't have this video, but drawn in various dimensions, this is going to be t to L, and this is going to be x in this system, cerium copper 6 minus x, I don't care, you're more familiar with gold, and this could be field. So at x equals 0, the t to L is a function field looks like this, and at b equals 0, t to L as a function of x looks like this. Now, what was your question?
Okay, so these two different, for example, power laws refer to dealing in temperature around two different points.
Yes.
On this phase diagram.
Yes. And then you can draw this if you had enough time and do something else. I mean, it's a multi-dimensional phase diagram.
Have you actually done this? And do you see where you actually get this crossover from gamma minus a square root of t to log t?
No, that's a huge amount of data.
Hey, Coleman.
Yes.
If I remember correctly, cerium copper gold, where the critical point is tuned to by doping,
right?
At low temperatures, early von Donhausen's data could be fit both by the square root and by log. However, overall, log would fit over a greater temperature range.
That's not the data that I have in my memory.
But we can discuss it later. But
in my review article
also. So the point of this, at this stage, the point is that they have two different points at which T and L goes to zero, and the temperature dependence is different.
Yes.
Okay.
So I seriously don't know if this will interest you, Pierce, but I definitely wanted to talk about materials issues, since the title of the talk was materials issues, and to point out that sometimes materials issues can be very important. And I know that you know this. I just wanted to give some examples, which I don't believe Brian showed when he was here, but again, trying to refer to something that you've seen. If you look at micrographs of the structure on a 50 micron scale for the prototypical non-thermal liquid system as discovered, the one that's of interest in terms of being at the quantum critical point and having non-thermal liquid behavior is this one. And you see there's a tremendous amount of brain boundary structure that's shown by microprobe results. That over the space of 10 microns, the compositional variation can be up to 30% in this doping system. This means of reaching this behavior. And then later, Gajewski, somebody, and Maple looked at reaching the quantum critical point using the isoelectronic scandium. And he mentioned this in his talk, but I don't believe he showed these graphs. And this is what the quantum critical point sample looks like on an electron backscattered micrograph, and you see that it's looking much more homogeneous. Question, did that affect the physics that you measured? Answer.
Is that also compatible with like a more global characterization, it's like a residual resistivity, is the scandium bulk the world's having smaller residual resistivity than the yttrium.
Since it's a dope, dirty system, no, they're not significantly different.
I can still compare the same amount of dope.
Right. But they weren't, those weren't the quite a critical point. The point two and the point three, it was a different amount of doping to get to where you wanted to be. So you're really comparing systems that have been built at a different level.
Okay.
So I just wanted to show you that you can also have second phase that's important. I'll skip over that. Low temperature properties can be very sample dependent. I just wanted to talk about the upturn in C over T that's going above log T in these three systems.
Can I stop you? So in the previous thing, the scandium dope was more homogeneous.
Yes.
And it was different in...
And it's not different.
It's not different.
So that's what I want to talk about on this first point. Okay. So I want to show you the low temperature specific heat from the original publication and point out there's this very rapid rise above log T or power law or however you want to fit it in the low temperature data of this system, and that reproduces for the 30% uranium and 70% scandium data. In other words, the fact that there were microscopic inhomogeneities and serious materials problems actually did not affect at least this particular behavior, which has been of some interest to theorists in the audience. In other words, what's the explanation for this rapid rise in C over T at lower temperature? It had nothing to do with sample problems. However, if you look at cerium nickel 2 germanium 2, which I believe has sort of disappeared from our site, I think people aren't really doing cerium nickel 2 germanium 2 these days. There are varying behaviors depending on the sample. So the original discovery paper seemed to show a saturation from the log behavior, which is the straight line here, and seemed to bend over and more follow the Maria Takimoto constant minus square root of T. If you then go on and look at a sample that we did in Augsburg, it actually saturates and looks very liquid-like at low temperature in the specific heat. And then if you look at some later work, which is published in a hard-to-find place, but it is out there, for various single crystals of cerium nickel 2 germanium 2 made by Geibel et al., you actually get, in one sample, you get a square root of T behavior, and in one example, you get, again, this this super divergence at low temperatures, as was seen in the uranium, yttrium, palladium 3 case. So there's extreme sample dependence in the system, and it's hard to know what the intrinsic behavior is, and I think people have given up. I think it's sufficiently difficult that they're not working on it anymore. Since I promised it to you outline, there's this upturn in the original discovery paper of ytterbium, rhodium, silicon by Tortorelli in 2000, but again showed this super logarithmic or above logarithmic behavior in the specific heat divided by temperature at lowest temperature. As they went down to lower temperatures, they discovered that that was in fact the high side of an anti-ferromagnetic transition. So that's always the worry when you have this strong upturn at lowest temperature. If you just went a little lower, could you find a transition? But we're still saved. Here's the log behavior, the dashed line, And when you put a field on and suppress the anti-ferromagnetism, even though there's not quite the strong upturn that Covarelli's on, there is still an upturn. And when they dope germanium, and Frank will be here, I believe, in the middle of next week, and he may talk about this, I don't know. When you dope with germanium, you still have this huge, super logarithmic or above logarithmic divergence in C over T at low temperature. So there's some intrinsic physics here in the ytterbium, rhodium, silicon case that's probably worth looking at. And I believe Catherine has a theory on this issue. Yeah. So it looks to be, it resists materials problems. This looks to be in the best stuff, not the best stuff, the dope stuff, not the dope stuff. This seems to be there intrinsically. So, discussing more or less my last point, when I was here in January, we talked about disordered systems, and we started off talking about uranium, copper, 4, palladium, and this is a special structure, it's a gold, beryllium, 5 structure. There are two sublattice sites for, if this were uranium, copper, 5, there are two sublattice sites for the copper to go on. There's a larger one, which is called the beryllium 1 site, and there are four smaller ones, which are called the beryllium 2 sites. Since palladium is larger than copper, there is some belief that there's sublattice order here. This belief is strengthened by what happens when you anneal at the 4-1 composition, since if you don't anneal, then you have disorder, so the palladium is going on a small site in addition to the large site where it might thermodynamically more stably go. It goes on the small sites, it expands the lattice, and so you get this behavior occurring before you get to x equal 1, it starts earlier. And so this is where the palladium, as you increase the palladium content, has to go on the smaller copper sites, and so you're expanding your lattice at a faster rate than here in the beginning when you're starting with pure uranium copper 5 and you're initially putting palladium on that copper site that's preferentially going on the larger site and not expanding the lattice as a function of palladium concentration quite so rapidly. So there is a possibility of sublattice ordering here, and this sublattice ordering is very important.
Greg, for those of us who don't speak German, getemper means?
Anneal, I'm sorry, okay. So we've seen the x-rays, the x-ray line width varies as a function of temperature handling. And the problem with the uranium copper 4 palladium system is it's very hard to tell what the intrinsic physics is. As you anneal it, the resistivity changes radically. These are, to get them all on one graph, these are ratios of the resistivity to the 300 Kelvin value. But if I look up here at these values, those samples have a residual resistivity of like 300 micron centimeters. If I anneal a sample here, then it has a residual resistivity of a sixth of that value, something like 50 micron centimeters. So getting the palladium to go more preferentially on the large beryllium one side violently affects what we thought were the intrinsic properties way back when this was first published. In other words, this has a very large negative slope, which at least one theorist wearing a mostly purple sweater once asked me if perhaps this was interesting from an intrinsic physics point of view, that it had such a large negative slope here. I think it's minus 6 micron per micron centimeter per Kelvin slope, that this is the largest known. Whether that might be of intrinsic interest. And as you anneal it, unfortunately, the large negative slope goes away, as well as the large residual resistivity. It's also true that the specific heat varies. Where PNAL goes to zero actually shifts with annealing. It shifts from, again, this is unannealed ilia. And Neil, I apologize for this. So the annealing and the sublattice order changes the specific heat too. So what you might have thought were intrinsic properties were in fact extrinsic. But having said all of that...
Can I just ask you, Brock, does the magnetic property change as with these different anneals?
Well, where T-nail goes to zero changes from palladium 1 to palladium 1.1.
There was a statement that it's just a uniform... Was that accessibility goes like 1 over T to 1/3. Does that change with annealing?
Lambda is 0.8 instead of 0.7, so it changes a little bit. But having said all of that, we still don't have perfect sublattice order. All of the palladium with the annealed sample is not on the beryllium 1 site, and in fact, some very pretty data from Kuo and Booth and co-workers shows that in the unannealed material, we had a 73% approximately occupation of the beryllium 1, the larger copper sublattice site, and with annealing, it only goes up to 81%. So it's still a disordered sample. So if you're looking for the physics at a quantum critical point in a disordered system, this is not the system to go looking at. And I trust the blogger will allow me to say that this is not an ideal system because this is my system. And so I'm obviously not calling anyone else's results into question. I'm calling our own results into question. And so what we did was we thought we would put nickel on this. And this is what I talked about last January. We would put nickel there because nickel is smaller than palladium. So rather than having the possibility of sublattice order, we'll have the smaller nickel going on the four smaller beryllium 2 sites, and so we'll have approximately 25% on each of the sites, so we'll have a huge amount of disorder. This was not a good idea because, and I'm getting to my ultimate words here, because in these doped, disordered, highly correlated systems, as we've seen repeatedly in earlier slides, you sometimes have materials problems, you have spurious effects, you have things that cover up the intrinsic behavior. And when we did nickel doping, it was very difficult, i.e. hard, impossible, to look at the temperature dependence of the low temperature susceptibility, because with increasing nickel, there's a transition here at around 25 Kelvin that gets larger and larger and more influential on the low temperature susceptibility, so it's hard to find out what the intrinsic temperature dependence is. So the suggestion for a better disordered system follows along with what someone said earlier in the audience. Let's look at stoichiometric compounds that are quantum critical in and of their own beautiful cells with no doping, and let's introduce disorder in those systems by various means, not including doping, and look at the quantum critical behavior as a function disorder in controlled stoichiometric systems. Because I think these doped systems, there are just too many distractions. There are second phases, there are homogeneity problems, which at least in the uranium yttrium palladium system did not distract from the low temperature specific heat, but there are transitions and things we didn't understand in the cerium thorium rhodium antimony system, which I showed early on in the talk. The thing to do for looking for disordered quantum critical behavior is to stay away from doping and try to introduce disorder in stoichiometric compounds. Thank you very much.
Can I?
Two questions. On the resistivity, you said it was at low temperatures characterized by noise. Couldn't one write in some experiments, because in many cases it is interesting to understand the resistance noise of the system. In particular, where if the system I look at is a small one and could actually reveal something about the system I'm measuring, this is an option.
If you could get the system clean enough and you could get your electrical spurious extrinsic noise low enough, sure. But the noise I was...
extrinsic noise?
Yes. The noise I was talking about was not in any sort of...
I suspect so, but one could in principle also look at very small systems. There were a number of talks here where non-equilibrium behavior close to a critical point, one critical point may give some relevance because order of limits are important and so on. So measuring the resistance noise at a quantum critical point may actually be something interesting. Yeah.
You know,
So I just came when I saw that, because there has to be some...
You're a small sample, for example.
Probably, yeah, because, yeah.
Well, then may I recommend that you have a small stoichiometric, well-ordered system?
Yeah, I think there seems to be no shortage of small samples, right?
Not one of your points. No, small on your scale is going to be smaller than something you can see in touch.
Right. Another point, the residual resistivity, probably it has been studied, as I go tuned through a quantum phase transition, how does it change, and is it really understood or experimentally understood, whether the residual resistivity feeds back and realizes that there is a quantum phase transition? That's scattering to the impurity, but being affected by the critical fluctuation.
That's an interesting question. I always thought that rho naught was a T equals zero property. You're implying that it could be affected by the quantum critical fluctuation.
Pressure dependence. As I go through the quantum critical point, I really don't change my disorder, I suppose, but the potential strength, something is being amplified by...
That's been looked at by von Lunaisen. I can dig that graph up. That he has looked at rho naught through the quantum critical point.
Those through metal-magnetic transitions, you also have seen the peaks in resistivity as you go through the metal-magnetic point. As indeed the Dandy McKenzie in their data.
Right. The cerium copper 5 gold, which I think is what you have in mind, where you tune the transition out of the epithermal magnet by pressure, they see just gigantic change.
Is this understood in relation?
Well, there was some
analysis by the watch,
but I'm not entirely sure that. I think it contains more information. But
I would say a clear discussion on it in general theory is still wanting.
Well, there is a stuff on the Schofield is doing in these days, which the magnetic field is in place. There's also this theory of the human release, which extends this for metamagnet.
Right, there's this stuff.
Yeah, so this is what, basically you aggregate some kind of impurity if you directly couple the disorder to the electron.
Okay.
You aggregate some structure on the...
But that's analyzing diffusion and all these things. It's only what Jordan was asking. I understand that, but still, it's diffusion corrections.
Yeah.
I thought you were more interested in quantum fluctuation.
Yeah, it's quantum fluctuations, something.
Quantum fluctuation. Did it find that there is increase of residual resistivity?
Yes, when you clear some domains, if you directly couple to the other parameter and it's increased with the resistivity, that's the whole step of that paper. It's between quantum fluctuations, plus this other one. So, that's...
Okay.
Right. Question. In the light of what you were saying, so as a theorist, I'm interested in knowing when I should stop worrying about things, all the things that might go wrong.
Never.
And
never.
Okay. The question is the following: that from some point, at some practical level, I should decide, okay, I trust these data, right? And you're on the record now, according to you, saying that you think that Andy McKenzie's results and are instructive and clean.
On his latest generation.
On the latest generation. Okay. So, what other materials are there in your view where you think that, for example, going to better crystals would not change dramatically what we are going to see?
Well,
change little details here and there.
That's a long list. I mean, I think most of the...
because we heard the complimentary in this talk. So.
I think, you know, most of the results out there are correct and represent intrinsic data. I don't have, I mean, I could give you a long list of systems where I think the purities of the systems and the residual resistivities are adequate. I think the disordered systems, they're mostly all inadequate.
But you know the answer. You can't afford to wait for some theories. Because if you wait till it goes down to 0.08, then by then, Andy Minnis and Andy Stockfield have written their paper on the mathematicism and their theory. You don't have the time for that. You've got to make a judgment. You've got to go for it. And if after the fact it turns out it's junk, well, you took a gamble and it was worth taking.
I trust that will be blocked. This comment should be blocked. This is classic knowledge. Classic knowledge.
I think we're done.
Thanks very much.